Hello, everyone, and welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European Macro Research at Natixis, and with me, as usual, is Klaus Adam, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim.
Yeah, hello also from my side. And we're going to restart our podcast in 2022 right away with a highlight. That is, we have a special guest with us today, Frank Smets. He's general director at the ECB and responsible for the Directorate Economics. And before getting to Frank, let's have a very quick update on the latest European macro data. Dirk.
Indeed, we had two noteworthy data points, I would think. First, this morning we got a UK November GDP number. The UK has a monthly GDP series. GDP was up 0.9 on the month, implying that the level of activity is now back to its pre-pandemic level. The recovery path, looking at the UK GDP and euro area GDP, is roughly similar. So one could be tempted to think that actually Brexit wasn't such a big deal after all, given that, again, both recovery trajectories look very similar. But I think it would be a mistake. The UK would have grown actually quite a bit stronger without Brexit. Anyway, that is certainly something we'll look into in the future. And then we had the euro area November industrial production figures. They were up on the month 2% after three consecutive declines. The obvious question here is that the light at the end of the tunnel? And indeed, there are some tentative signs that the supply side bottleneck problems are getting smaller. And car production, for which we have December numbers, indeed has increased. But it's obviously too early to say anything conclusive or definitive here. But let's move on to Frank. Klaus?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dirks, for this. So now let's move on to our main act. Happy to welcome Frank Smets. Frank, it's great to see you.
Hi, Klaus. Hi, Dirk. Very nice being here.
Yeah, so Frank, you have been with central banking at the ECB for more than two decades. And throughout this time, you have been in a rather unique position to observe the changes that took place at the ECB and in the euro system at large. While ECB board members and central bank governors come and go, you were serving in rather exposed positions that gave you great insights into the decision-making process and also how it has changed over long spans of time. So back in 2004 to 2008, when I was still at ECB, you were my boss, first as head of monetary policy research and then as director general for research. And you then moved on to become Mario Draghi's personal advisor for several years before then moving to your current position as Director General for Economics. As such, you're responsible for the economic analysis of the euro area, but also for the macroeconomic projections, which have lately come into renewed focus. So, but currently you're on leave from the ECB to explore something new. So how does it feel not to be at ECB after all these years, Frank?
Well, I'm still wrapping up at the ECB. We'll go on leave on the 1st of February. So I don't think it has sunk down completely. But I mean, after 22 years at the European Central Bank, I'm very much looking forward to taking this longer 1 year break. I hope to use it to do some traveling, to see some friends, but also to read and think a little bit about this awkward world we are living in. At the same time, of course, it's with mixed feelings that I'm because I'm leaving behind a very interesting and challenging position at the heart of policymaking. So mixed feelings.
Yeah, we hope you'll be able to travel despite the pandemic and all that, and wish you all the best for this break. So but coming back at, to your time at the ECB, you've been in charge there together with others, of course, of managing the process for the revision of the ECB's monetary policy strategy. So that was quite an important task. And so how happy are you with the changes to the strategy that have been agreed?
I mean, overall, I'm very happy with the outcome. I mean, the new strategy is not a revolution, but it's an evolution. And I think it has clarified a number of things, probably most importantly, the symmetry of the 2% inflation target. So the ECB has joined the many 2% flexible inflation targeters in the world. Moreover, I think the whole process was a very inclusive one, where different departments at the ECB, but also all the NCBs have contributed a lot. And I think that that also has resulted in sort of a general approval of the new strategy. I mean, apart from the 2% symmetric inflation target, I mean, the important element of the new strategy is also this recognition, that we are living in a low interest rate environment, a low R-star environment, and that has implications for how monetary policy has to respond to disinflationary shocks. So the recognition that we have to be forceful and persistent in order to avoid that low inflation gets entrenched and affects inflation expectations.
Is that the most important change looking back over the last 20 years, or are there other changes where you would say compared to the beginning of the monetary union and looking at the strategy now, that this is the biggest change? Of course, the assessment of inflation or the underlying dynamics and all that's a big change. But any other points that you would stress where the ECB's thinking has clearly evolved a lot over the last 20 years?
Yeah, well, I think it is definitely the most important change that drove the core of the new strategy. So the 2% symmetric target, the sort of asymmetric reaction function, but also the fact that we will have to live longer and more frequently close to the lower bound, which means sort of the mainstreaming of the other instruments, large-scale asset purchases, targeted long-term refinancing operations, forward guidance. So this realization that this is there to stay as long as we are in this low R-star environment, but also the role of fiscal policy. We looked at that. I mean, of course, this is not core of the strategy, but the fact that in these low interest rate environments, other policies can play a complementary role to monetary policy to maintain price stability, I think, is also an important realization. But of course, it's not the only change. And of course, that change is also related to many other structural changes, like lower productivity growth, population aging, globalization, digitalization. All these structural changes, to some extent, we looked at and sort of try to analyze what it means for monetary policy making. Another important change that I would highlight is sort of the communication environment. I mean, obviously, over the past two decades, the role of social media, for example, has become very important. And so one outcome of the strategy review was to try to have a more layered communication, or not only reach out to analysts like yourselves, but experts, but also to the more lay people, to the general public. And then finally, I mean, of course, I cannot answer this question without also mentioning climate change as a big new topic on the agenda of central banks. Also, that, of course, has had an impact on the new strategy.
If I just may add on, from a pure market perspective, I would personally think that the willingness of the ECB to play lender of last resort for governments, I think that's the most fundamental shift, because that was up to the famous speech, Draghi speech, the big uncertainty here. Would the ECB be willing to bail out countries if there would be a significant liquidity crisis? There was never a doubt that the UK, the Bank of England, would bail out the US Treasury. And that uncertainty that was lingering on, that has gone. And I think, at least for crisis times, that's a huge change. It has nothing specifically to do with the strategy, but I guess that was clearly a missing part in the toolbox. And of course, there are conditions and all that, but it has shifted the risk surrounding the monetary union quite a bit, I think.
Yes, of course. I mean, in terms of the big changes, I mean, the first decade was, remember the Great Moderation period. So it was a very, to some extent, from today's perspective, very simple macroeconomic environment with low volatility, both in economic activity and in inflation. And then with the global financial crisis, sovereign debt crisis, now the pandemic crisis, obviously big shocks happened, and in particular, financial stability concerns became very important. And I think that has had a big impact in a number of ways. First of all, in terms of our analysis, one of the changes in the new strategy is also that we try to integrate much more, our economic analysis and our monetary and financial analysis, but also in terms of our instrument set and the importance of not only thinking about the stance, but also about the transmission of our monetary policy. And that's where I think sort of the intervention in financial markets in order to ensure a smooth transmission of our policy across markets, across jurisdictions, I mean, that has become also very, very important. I mean, I would not characterize this as bailing out governments. No. I mean, it's really about making sure that our policy stance reaches, all parts of the euro area. It's not about bailing out. And obviously, central bank could not. I mean, if there's a fundamental sustainability problem, there's not much central bank can do about that. But if there is a liquidity, a self-fulfilling equilibrium, that or a self-fulfilling attack that arises, then the central bank can stop that, and that definitely is something where we have seen this change too. Yes,
right. So one other thing that when Dirk and I looked at many years of ECB experience that we noticed changed is the ECB personnel in terms of who gets perhaps appointed to the board. So in the first ECB board, after the ECB was created, it was that board members were mainly former central bankers, economists, and academics. And then after their experience at the ECB, they would move on to become government officials. I'm thinking here of, Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, who became Italian finance minister after his term at the ECB, or Lucas Papademos, who became Greek prime minister after his time at the ECB. Also, Vito Gaspar, who was, director general research, later became finance minister in Portugal. Now, this seems to have changed a bit over time here. More recently, board members often held political positions first and thereafter moved on to these positions at the ECB board. I'm thinking here of Luis de Guindos, who was economy minister in Spain before moving to the ECB, but also Christine Lagarde, who held various ministerial positions in the French government and even was IMF head, which is also quite a political position. So do you think these trajectories, which in a certain sense have reversed directions, have had consequences for the way decisions are formed and also for the kind of discussions that take place in the governing council or at the board?
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with your premise or that there's a trend, a reversal in this sense. I mean, it's clear that a number of members of the Governing Council currently have been ministers before. I mean, there's not only the president and the vice president, but also the Slovakian, the Portuguese, the Maltese, the Finnish governors were ministers before they joined the Governing Council. But I think this revolving door between central banks and government has always been there. I mean, the first ECB president, Wim Duisenberg, I mean, he was a governor of the Dutch Central Bank, but he had also been a finance minister early on in his career. I mean, similarly, Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, was a commissioner before joining the ECB. So I think this has always been sort of, and I think it's a quite natural revolving door between these two parts of government. But what I think is very important is that the policymakers have a good financial and economic knowledge so that they can appreciate the economic and monetary and financial analysis that they are presented in the preparation of the policy meetings. And of course, for that reason, it's also good to have some top economists at our board. And I think with Philip Lane, with Isabel Schnabel, with Fabio Panetta, we also have those in our committee. But secondly, probably what's equally important is that they're independent. No, and of course, that is key because they need to take this euro area perspective. I mean, that's really our mandate is about price stability for the euro area. Now, then whether if you have been a finance minister or not, you're more or less affected. I mean, I don't think that matters a lot.
And so, in some sense, you could argue that having the political career before the ECB time could foster independence rather than, you know, someone who has to look still for a political position. At the same time, you could argue, you know, once you have been in the finance ministry, you internalize more their thinking once you have arrived at the ECB. So it could go either way. It's not clear a priori. So, but have you seen any changes in the nature of discussion that you could sort of link to these developments or not? Or
I mean, I think it's of course natural for members of the governing council to have the situation of their home country in the back of their mind, because that's what they know best. And governors often also play the role of a national economic policy advisor in no different context than monetary policy for that matter. And personally, I think this is actually a strength of the governing council and more generally of the Eurosystem committee structure, that these different national perspectives are brought to the table. This diversity, I think, improves the information set, particularly since the global financial crisis, and even before, but when heterogeneity in the monetary union is very important, and one has to just deal with that. I mean, one cannot ignore it. And from that perspective, I think it also robustifies the decision making. But again, of course, while it's very important to acknowledge those heterogeneities and those different perspectives, I mean, in the end, when each member makes his or her decision, it's important that they take this euro area perspective. And I mean, overall, I think this is still the case.
Could you think of any institutional changes? So you said there is not a bias when governing council members make their decisions, but could there be any other changes to be made to ensure that that's indeed the case? I mean, some have argued that there is a bias, and I think a German ZEW Institute put out a study where they looked at decisions and the financial situation of a home country in order to argue there is indeed the bias, and you said there is not. I would tend to agree in principle, but is there any mechanism one could think up to ensure that is indeed the case? I don't know.
I mean, one interesting discussion here is whether to have attribution of views in the minutes. No, I mean, so far I think we have been arguing, and we're still arguing, that actually it protects individual members of the governing council from national political pressure by not having attribution. But of course, one could argue the opposite too, that actually making clear what individual members of the governing council say in the policymaking decisions would make them more accountable. So you could check whether they indeed do take a euro area perspective. I mean, I personally, I don't have sort of strong views on this, but that is something that one could then. I mean, if one believes in the second part, then and I think some members of the governing council think that would be a good idea, then that could strengthen. But I think it works again. It works in both ways, so I'm not sure.
Right. So you mentioned that the, you know, the past 10 years of the ECB have been a rough ride, so to speak, with many crises that it had to confront. And in response to that, the ECB has demanded an upgrade to the institutional setup of the euro area to avoid being always in the front line here. And in fact, a lot has happened, you know, since the euro area was created. The ESM, for example, is now a permanent institution, you know, standing there in the background to step in should something go wrong. But do you think enough has been done on this front? And, you know, would you subscribe to the view that is sometimes expressed that the monetary union without a fiscal union is eventually, you know, going to fail?
I would not put it that starkly, although obviously we have to move in the direction of a fiscal union, but of course that has to go along also with more political union, and so it's not something that one can force. I mean, clearly our monetary union is still incomplete in a number of directions. And that does imply that sort of the degree of private and public risk sharing that is necessary to smooth out asymmetric shocks in a single currency area is much less than in comparable monetary unions like the United States. And I think it's clear that this makes our monetary union vulnerable in the sense that if you have big asymmetric shocks, then no. One can think about situations where a country thinks the costs become larger than the benefits. So as a possibility, I think you cannot exclude it. But of course, one, I think, should not underestimate the political commitment to the monetary union. I mean, we've had big shocks in the past decade. And the monetary union, or the political commitment, clearly has made sure that in response changes have happened, and so a lot of progress has been made. And I mean, you mentioned the crisis management framework and the role of the ESM, but of course one should also mention banking union and financial union, common banking supervision now being done at the ECB. I mean, here, clearly, it's still incomplete in the sense that I think we need to go in the direction of also a common deposit insurance scheme, again, to further enhance the private sector risk sharing in this area. And then thirdly, of course, on fiscal, I mean, it's no platitude to say that Europe is made in crisis, but again, in response to the pandemic crisis, a big step has been made. I mean, for the first time, we have a large scale issuance of basically joint EU bonds. No, we're talking about 750 billion euros. It does create a sort of a new asset class. It does create a safe European EU asset, it has risk sharing properties. Again, it's an ad hoc temporary program, it has transfers more skewed to those countries that have been affected the most by the pandemic crisis. Now, it's temporary, it's an ad hoc program, so it's definitely not not enough or not the end. But it, again, it shows that the European Union can act when necessary. And so let's see what the forthcoming review of the governance the governance framework in the monetary union will bring. So they're obviously many proposals now, and we'll have to see, but I would say progress is being made.
In your current position, you're also responsible for the projections, the ECB inflation growth projections and all that. And at least in the past, I think one could argue there was a systemic upward bias in inflation forecast, in the sense that the ECB projections always expecting inflation to pick up, and it hasn't happened the way we undershot for a long time, and that was also behind the strategy review and the ECB's target. What can explain this systemic downward bias, and is there now a risk that the bias may be in the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear we've had a sort of an upward bias for a long time, from basically 2014 to, let's say, 2020, where we sort of have over-predicted inflation. But as you point out, actually, the last five rounds, we have been under-predicting inflation. And so if you actually do a systematic forecast evaluation over, let's say, the whole EMU period, there hasn't been a systematic bias, but clearly there is persistence in the forecast errors, and of course that is kind of well known that this can happen when you have structural changes or changes in the process. I mean, this is one of the issues that we did look into in the context of the strategy review, and there's an occasional paper on this topic that we published last September. And I would say they're basically, I mean, clearly it's easy to understand why inflation was low after 2014. No, we just came out of a double dip recession, sovereign debt crisis, big output gap, and so that put downward pressure on inflation. What is less less easy to understand is why that low inflation was so persistently low, why it took basically until recently for inflation to turn back to 2% and above, in spite of what has been a relatively easy monetary policy response. And I think this occasional paper basically points to two main factors. I mean, the first one has to do again with being at the lower bound. I mean, the reaction in the ECB to use unconventional measures was a bit slower than in other jurisdictions, partly because of the incomplete EMU framework, where it was not necessarily obvious that we could intervene at large scale in government bond markets. And of course, at the lower bound, this basically means that it affects inflation expectations. So inflation expectations became less well anchored. They were responding to the low inflation, partly because also our inflation aim was not very clear, and particularly the symmetry was not very clear. So that's one factor, this interaction between lower bound disinflationary shock affecting inflation expectations, which didn't make inflation more persistent by itself. And the other element that is highlighted is that probably we underestimated the size of the output gap. So in real time, we thought the output gap was closed by 2017. More or less, whereas if we now look back, there probably were a number of reasons why supply was higher than we expected. Initially, mostly in the labor market, we basically in the period 15, 16, 17, we underestimated employment growth and overestimated wage inflation. And when you look at it, so this is just positive labor supply shocks, and indeed, particularly labor force participation by women and by older workers, partly in response to structural reforms, was much bigger than we had expected. So there was a positive supply shock. On top of that, of course, we have globalization, we had outsourcing, we had migration, and so I think we kind of underestimated that. And then later on, as wage inflation did start responding to the closing of the output gap and the drop in unemployment, we were surprised by the slow pass-through from wages to prices. And again, I think part of it is the low inflation environment where pricing power was much less, but part of it is some of the structural, longer-term structural changes that again, are hard to to fully assess in real time related to globalization, outsourcing, but also related to digitalization. So pricing power was quite limited. And I think a big question now is, are we now at a turning point where some of these factors are changing? And obviously, we would like to avoid that we have now 5 years of underprediction of inflation.
Right. There are a lot of structural changes here that have certainly happened. Now, at the ECB, you're also in charge of the so-called macro modeling group, and you have written yourself one of the most cited scientific papers in this area. So you are sort of an expert here, the right man in charge. So how much progress do you think has there been made, you know, in developing better models over the past 20 years? And in particular, how useful do you find these economic models for the practical, you know, decision-making process in, you know, at the ECB?
Yes. There is no alternative to not having a model. So, I mean, in the end, what does one do in monetary policy making? One has to first focus on price stability, obviously. One first has to understand what drives the current inflation developments. Based on that, forecast inflation, no? Develop the inflation outlook. And then think about how, you know, what change in the monetary policy stance is needed to ensure that inflation returns to target. I mean, in order to do that, you need an economic model. No, whether it's implicit or explicit, you need to reason through what are the underlying sources, how do they affect the economy, and how does monetary policy have to respond to that. So I think you cannot do without models. What of course is true is that the uncertainty is very high. No, the uncertainty about the empirical relationships, uncertainty about the structural ratio, the type of model, that uncertainty about how expectations are formed. And so realizing that basically means that, you have to take kind of a risk management approach in there. So you have to have a suite of models. And to some extent, the art of using models for monetary policy is to also decide on which models to rely more on for which questions. No? And that's the approach at the ECB. I mean, we of course have some core models, there is a large suite of models. Some of them are more empirical, some of them are more theoretical, some are aggregated, some are country specific, hopefully this kind of robustify a bit the inference one takes from all this analysis. I mean, having said that, I mean, clearly, before the global financial crisis, there was a little bit too much, you know, focus on one particular model, and I may have contributed to that in the past. And so, I think a good thing since the global financial crisis is that there's much more diversity in terms of not only the type of models but also the mechanisms that you want to look at. And I think we have made a lot of progress in terms of thinking more about heterogeneity in of households, of firms, thinking more about alternative ways in which expectations are modeled. And of course, you, Klaus, have worked a lot on that too. And also thinking more about what are the key non-linearities. You know, most of our models are still linear models because they are easy to handle. But we know the world is not linear. There are non-linearities. And so thinking, what are the key non-linearities? Is it balance sheet constraint? Is it the effective lower bound? Is it downward nominal wage rigidity? And what does it mean for macroeconomic equilibria? I think is also important. And again, a lot of progress has been made, but there will always be kind of not just science, also an art to bring the different pieces of analysis together. But I don't think there's an alternative.
There will always be work for Modeler, that's for sure. Well, listening to you, Frank, it's clear that the last 20 years at the ECB were quite exciting, interesting, and stressful, but something tells me the next 20 years will be too. In any case, thanks for your time today, and we wish you all the best for the future.